Good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, virtual audience, for joining us. And I'm going to ask you to welcome TJ Newman, who's going to be walking towards us.
Thank you.
And there she is. See, she learned to walk like that on airplanes, right? We already. Yeah, we do.
Before I forget, I'm sat on my phone. I'll get in trouble if I don't take a selfie.
Okay. And then. We could both turn off the sound, right?
Do not disturb.
All right, this is a good moment to ask you all to turn off your phones and put them on do not disturb or whatever you want to do.
So smile.
I can't do that anymore. I don't think I can bend back that far. So I actually thought about coming down here. I was telling Tori in my pajamas because that's how most people fly anymore, as far as I can work out. But I'm really happy that it is now after Memorial Day and white pants are back. Any of you still stick to that old thing about, you know, I swear it's really, you know, it's ridiculous anymore, but I still have trouble pulling them out of my closet before Memorial Day.
So I almost wore white pants tonight, and in my mind, I tried them on, and I was like, oh, it's after Memorial Day. I can wear them. It's a thing. It's a thing.
And white shoes. I look like a nurse. Do you remember when white stockings were, you know, years ago, that was that craze? And I remember I went to work at the Library of Congress one day, and I had on white stockings and my white shoes, and people asked me if I were the new nurse. Oh, well. So we're here to talk about your previous incarnation as a flight attendant, because that is so germane to talking tonight about drowning and falling, which we, I think, still have maybe a few copies of up front in paperback, and which we launched with you last year. Or was it the year before?
July of 2021.
It was 2 years ago,
yeah.
Almost.
I can't believe that, yeah.
Me either. I thought it was like last year.
It feels like it was last year, shorter than that, yeah.
Okay, so I know you've told your backstory a zillion times, but for those who haven't heard it, give us a brief review.
Sure. I was born on a Tuesday at 8. No. Yeah, so as you alluded to, I was a flight attendant. I flew for 10 years, starting with Virgin America in San Francisco, and then I transferred to Los Angeles. But before I was a flight attendant, well, let's just bring it all the way back to the very beginning. I went to college for musical theater. Then I moved to New York City, and I tried my hand at that. Yeah, you're laughing. It's not pretty. Obviously, we're not talking about what my next show is. It didn't go very well. And I've got a lot of friends and family here who were there for that round of not what's the opposite of not success, failure, I guess.
Listen, Tori, everything you do is grist for the writer's mill. So everything you did that didn't work out has brought you to be a writer. So, you know, you should embrace it.
Absolutely. As you're crying yourself to sleep, it's like, this could be a great scene.
That's right.
Use it. Yeah. But so New York was rough, and I ended up leaving New York and moved back home. Moved back in with my parents, did the whole, you know, mid-20s living in your childhood bedroom, not sure what you're going to do with your life, what's going to happen now that I have a degree in musical theater, and the whole musical theater community just told me I wasn't good enough to do musical theater. So I'm doing that whole phase, and my mom, genius that she is, suggests that I apply to Changing Hands Bookstore up the street, the indie bookstore in Tempe, and so I do, and I get a job there. And it was really what I consider sort of the first step mm-hmm. in this journey to being a professional writer. And that it was when I started to dream again. It was when I started to use the creative aspects that weren't going anywhere. I'm a creative person. I'm a storyteller. I knew that wasn't going anywhere. But having just come from New York and so publicly falling flat on my face, I was hesitant to put myself out there again. I kind of felt like I'd used up my personal quota of, you know, public creative risk taking. But working at the bookstore, it really let me start to think again on my own. I would write at night in my bedroom. Nobody knew this. I didn't tell anybody I was writing. You know, when I'd go to the store and I would shelve books by an author with my last name, I would take my thumb and I would cover, you know, the first name, and I would pretend that I was shelving my own book. And my time at Changing Hands was when my dreams of being a published writer really became a concrete goal. And I ended up leaving the store to become a flight attendant. That's sort of the next step in the process. My mom was a flight attendant. My sister was a flight attendant. We call it the family business. So I left to be a flight attendant and loved it. Absolutely loved the job. And it was there that I had the idea for my first book, Falling. And once I had the idea for that book, I knew it would be a book. Like, I had the idea and I was like, I got to write that. So then I started writing on planes. I worked red eyes and I would write on red eye flights. I'd put the passengers to sleep and I would go to work and I would write by hand in the forward galley. And little bit by little bit, you know, page by page, sometimes just a cocktail napkin that I could just scribble down a quick note on, I put together a book. And that became Falling. And then I took that book and I went out into the world to find an agent, because that's what you need in the literary world. You got to have an agent. You can't just go to Simon & Schuster and say, you know, do I have a book
for
you?
Not anymore. Once upon a time, you could have.
That maybe so, but yeah, I'm sure, yeah. And you used to just submit it, like, print it off and take it in and just go to the editor.
There was a whole thing called throwing it over the transom. You know, you could go to New York and, like, toss it. But that went away a long time ago as book publishing has become more and more corporate.
And also probably with the advent of email. Once it could become like a digital submission, then you could send out, you know, it a million times. And I'm sure that changed.
Well, that's absolutely true. But think about how airplane travel has changed. I'll give you like a personal thing. I almost didn't go back to Stanford from Chicago because I was so sick on the DC-7 flight from Chicago to San Francisco. When I went there as a freshman and came home for Christmas, you know, the weather was horrible in Chicago. The airport was whatever. And I told my parents I didn't think I could go back. And my father said, they're going to put in a commercial jet in the spring. So if you go back one more time on the DC-7, you won't have to fly a prop plane again. And he was right. But, you know, think about how air travel has, you know, changed from, that was 1958. It's completely different, you know. In the 10 years that you were flying, it has become completely different. So you were probably there when it was actually more fun.
I had a good time.
Fewer angry passengers. No, seriously. You know, it didn't used to be. Did you read about the Korean guy that thought, you know, he just opened the door to the plane when they were about to land? People didn't used to do stuff like that.
Yeah, I feel like that was a one-off, though. I don't see that becoming a trending thing. At least I hope not.
Or it's material for your third book.
There you go, exactly.
Right, but I mean, really, you know, I think publishing has changed and, you know, flying has changed. So maybe you did it for the period you were supposed to. And it's also given you a terrific resource of people you can ask questions, because even flight attendants probably don't know everything there is to know about what happens in drowning.
Oh, definitely not. You know, the whole story is about a ditching. You know, and a ditching is a emergency landing on water. The aviation term is a ditching. And, you know, we go over extensively in training what you do, what the protocol is, and we train for it. We get in the pool. We, you know, do the whole thing. We build the raft. We wear the vest. We do the whole thing. But they don't actually cover what to do if the plane then sinks with people trapped inside. So I did research from there.
I mean, you've obviously got credibility with people who do know that stuff, and it helps that you were part of that community before you wrote the book.
Definitely. I have a lot of, I call on my phone a pilot friends, and they're colleagues that I used to work with that I ask questions of. And when I was figuring out how to make what I wanted to have happen in this book happen, which I always forget, like, today's publication day, by the way. Thank you for joining me on publication day. That's so exciting. Thank you. Thank you. But I always forget when it's this early, like, most people in here probably haven't read the book. Is that right? Yeah, okay, so I should probably, like, tell you what the book is actually about. That might be helpful.
Well, we were going to get to that.
Oh, we were getting to that.
We were getting to that.
We were just getting warmed up.
This was just background stuff.
Just background stuff.
I wanted them to think that you actually knew what you were writing about.
Oh, we're
and now we've
them.
Established that.
Yeah. Okay. Cool.
Yay! It's like the prologue.
Yeah, I got it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So why don't you start with Falling for people who missed it, and just give us a brief review of Falling, and then we'll move to Drowning.
Sure. Absolutely. Falling. the idea for Falling, that's sort of the best way to lead into what Falling is. I had the idea for Falling at work on a red eye. I love red eyes. They're my favorite flights. And I was working a red eye and I was standing at the front of the plane and we were doing a bathroom break for the pilots. So the pilots, you know, I'm standing at the front like this. You guys are actually like a plane. I'm standing in the aisle looking out into the audience or the plane and everyone's asleep. You know, it's a red eye. It's dark. It's cold. Everyone's asleep. And I have this thought that their lives, my life, crewmates' lives, all of our lives are in the hands of the pilots, which is fairly obvious. I mean, they're flying the plane. That's kind of obvious. But it was the first time that I thought of the flip side of that, which is that with that much power and responsibility, how vulnerable does that make the pilots? And I really couldn't shake the thought. And a few days later, I was working a different trip with a different set of pilots. And I just said to the captain that I was flying with one day, I said to him, like, hey, what would you do if, your family was taken and you were told, you know, if you didn't crash the plane, that they would be killed? What would you do? And the look on his face terrified me. Because I knew he didn't have an answer. And I knew that that terrified him. And that was the moment that I realized I had the makings of my first book.
So then you had to figure out how to make all that actually work.
Yeah, exactly. And then I started thinking, it's so funny. I was talking to a pilot friend last night who was talking to me about this stuff. And he's like, you know, it's so funny. When I look back now, you did ask so many questions. And I was like, yeah. And he was like, I always thought that you were just like, I don't know, maybe you wanted to be a pilot or you were just like really curious or liked flying. And I was like, well, I am curious and I do like flying, but I was using you. I was doing research that whole time. I was finding out how to do this.
Right. Okay. So drowning, you successfully piloted Falling to the finish line. Now what?
So when I was trying to figure out what my follow-up should be, what my next book should be about, I didn't know what I wanted it to be, but I knew one thing for sure, and that was that it had to be bigger. Like in every aspect, it had to be bigger. Bigger heart, bigger action, bigger stakes. It just had to be bigger. And so I started sort of going back through all the thoughts and story ideas that I had on the plane, because there were a lot. And I remembered a flight, another red eye, always on a red eye, and I was standing in the forward galley and we were going Hawaii to Los Angeles, and I'm looking out the porthole window, right, in the door, the small porthole window, and I'm looking out the window and I'm looking out at nothing, right? There's nothing out there for hours and miles in every direction. It is nothing but pitch black void, nothing but water. And of course, the way my brain works, the wheels start turning and I start thinking, what if something happened? Like, what if we went down? How would they find us out here? How would they come get us? How would they save us? How would we save ourselves? And then I just sort of kept going. And that was the moment that I went back to when I was working on this. And I kind of took that concept and I thought, what would worst case scenario be? Like, if we're talking about a ditching, what would the absolute worst case scenario be? And I thought, well, plane that survives the crash, but then sinks, with people trapped inside, and then is teetering on the edge of an undersea cliff. And that was kind of like the worst case scenario that I could come up with. And that was the starting point. And then I just reverse engineered it to the beginning to figure out, well, what would the conditions need to be in order to make that actually happen?
Right. Well, I mean, if you're going to fall into the water, gives you a slightly better chance than on land. But the truth is, you know, if you start to sink, there's a point when the pressure of the water is going to crush the airplane and everything inside it. So you can only go down a certain way. Now, why in the book, you could tell us that anyway, because we already know it's gone down, why doesn't it keep floating? Why does it begin to sink?
Well, I thought they were kind of engineered
to float, but apparently they're not.
No, they are. They definitely are, which is an argument that one of the characters in the book fairly early on makes. It's tough because, like, this early, nobody's read it. Like, I could totally deep dive into this whole thing.
All right,
but
don't spoil things. Don't do it.
Yeah. No spoilers.
No, that's fair.
But that was, to your point, it was really tricky to figure out, and I didn't think it was possible. Once I came up with this idea and I was like, that would be really cool, then it was like, okay, but how do I actually do that? Because everything in me wanted to be like, this shouldn't happen. So that's when the research came in. That's when I started consulting with people and started trying to figure out, like, well, how could I make this happen? And I,
you've taken away such a safety net. We flew to Tahiti last year. I'm 7 hours over water from San Francisco to Papeete, and I was thinking, that's okay. You know, if we go down, we'll float. Right. There are islands out there now.
They are designed to do that. And I feel like this should also give a little bit of comfort in that I had to work so hard to figure out how to crash this plane.
Yeah.
Planes do not want to crash, and pilots do not want to crash them. And literally trying to figure out how to make it actually happen was so difficult. Yeah. So that should be a big comfort. And every one of my phone pilot friends that I would talk to, I'd be like, okay, well, what about this? What about this? And then they'd solve the problem. I'd be like, no, I don't want to solve the problem. I want to make the problem worse. I know I'm asking you to literally do the opposite of everything you are hardwired to do, but... work with me here. We're looking for catastrophe, not a happy ending.
Right. I've spent almost my entire adult life in the air, you know. I mean, not as a flight attendant, but traveling all the time. I'm going to fly to Antarctica next year. I'm flying to, you know, I'm beginning to think that ships may be as dangerous as airplanes, too. So what are we doing? But, you know, car crashes are. I mean, you know, I was did a lot of personal injury work as an attorney, and I've always thought I'd just as soon go down in the plane as be in a car crash, because the results, it's okay if you die, but it's not so good if you survive in pieces, and that's what happens in car crashes way too often. So, you know, that cured me of any fear of flying, but now you've given it to me all the way again. Anyway, but basically, it's a really neat story because it's a family story. So we can talk about that a little bit, right?
We can talk about that because...
It's not a complete catastrophe. There are relationships in this book.
No, yeah. I realized very early in the writing process that the spectacle of it, you know, a crash and flames and explosions and a sinking plane and all that, like, that is not going to sustain a reader's attention for 300 pages. It's just not. And so I knew that the book had to be about... the people. Like, who are these people in this plane? Why do I care if they make it out of here? And I decided to center the story around one family, Will Kent, and his 11-year-old daughter, Shannon. And they are two of the people who are trapped inside the plane. And her mother and his soon-to-be ex-wife is topside leading the rescue mission. And so the entire story is the race against time and impossible odds to save the 12 people and to bring a family back together. And the relationship is strained because they had experienced tragedy in their life before this event, which we get that nice backstory coming into it. And that's what the story is. And it's been interesting, actually, to sort of talk about this book and market this book and get people interested in, like, the spectacle and, like, the big stuff, but then also say, like, no, it's a deeply emotional story. It's really, like, I should have kept a tally of the number of tissue boxes I went through as I was writing this thing. And I have to say, it's maybe this is sick on my part when people are like, I cried so hard. I'm like, yes. Yes. But it's a...
You're your own audience. I love that. Yeah. Well, it's true. That is what she's doing, right? But, you know, that's good, because if you feel that emotion, then we will. So there was an airplane almost catastrophe book years ago called the movie called The High and the Mighty. Do any of you remember seeing The High and the Mighty? I think it was John, was it John Wayne or somebody, was John Wayne, wasn't it? Was the pilot. And it was a flight from Hawaii to Los Angeles or San Francisco, I can't remember which. And there was some problem with the fuel tank. And they passed the point where they could go back to Hawaii, but they didn't have enough fuel to make it to California. And as you point out, there's nothing in the middle. So that was the ticking clock, was whether they were actually going to make it. But then the movie was clearly not about the crash. The movie was about all the people on the plane, their backstories, you know, how they were feeling. It was, you know, a very emotional, very character-driven movie, but that was the background. If you haven't seen it, I won't tell you how it comes out. But, you know, same sort of issue you're asking about, which is, you know, what do you do if there's nothing there?
Yeah.
No place to land.
Exactly.
And probably this was a long time ago. How long ago was it? Do you remember? Must have been in the 60s, I think. Might have even been a prop plane, now that I think about it. Anyhow, so it wouldn't have had large fuel reserves, and there wasn't all the GPS stuff and, you know, abilities to, I don't know.
Locate,
I don't. Yeah. They couldn't have refueled it. You know, Navy jet, you can refuel in midair, but I don't think that's possible with passenger jets, is it?
Not that.
I don't think so.
Not the plane in this book, no. Yeah.
No, but I. Yeah. Well, that wouldn't have. Yeah. But I mean, I wonder in general. I don't think there's anybody familiar with whether you can actually refuel a passenger jet. I don't think so. I don't think there's any mechanism set up for that.
Yeah. I always
wondered how they do it. You know, in the Navy, as they fly by, I always think, you know, it looks like two dragonflies mating or something.
Yeah,
it's so weird.
Like, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But
little fun fact, by the way, the flight from Hawaii to the mainland, that is the longest flight in the entire world that does not have a suitable alternate. Meaning that if something goes wrong, an alternate is like, you know, we're going to land and somewhere else. That is the longest flight path in the entire world that does not have a suitable alternate.
Really?
Yeah.
So when I flew to Papeete, the alternate was Hawaii?
Yeah, it probably was. Yeah,
that's the only thing I can think of between...
Yeah, because if you look at the map, it really is like
French
mainland
Polynesia.
Hawaii, and then you start, you know, heading
it comes
east,
down a little bit, to French Polynesia. Here's an interesting thing, talking about diversion, but we will anyway, that I learned when we were in French Polynesia going around. Bora Bora, many of you may have seen all the glamour shots of the lagoon and the over-the-water hollies and so forth in Bora Bora, and it looks so glamorous, and it's a huge tourist thing. When the fleet was attacked at Pearl Harbor, the Navy took the surviving ships and rushed them down to French Polynesia. And the only place they could figure out to put them was in the interior lagoon of Bora Bora. So they blew it up. They blew up the coral wall that protected it. And that's why cruise ships can go there, thanks to the U.S. Navy in 1941. But, I mean, to your point, because that was apparently the closest place to Hawaii, that they felt like they could take the remains of the fleet while they figured out what the next step was going to be.
Wow.
I know.
Wow.
Because it's a volcano. I mean, those islands are all volcanoes, Hawaii and the whole bit. And when the caldera collapsed at Bora Bora, it created this great big lagoon all around it. But then the coral reef that grows up around volcanoes, the coral reef survived. And that's why there was this huge interior on the inside of the coral reef. And that was the place they could keep the Navy. I mean, that's why I love travel. Why would you ever know that if you hadn't gone on that trip, right?
Yeah, I love that.
Me too. But it is true that there's not much out there.
Yeah, there's nothing out there. Yeah. Yeah. And that was cool. Also, a fun component of the research was trying to figure out when I was, you know, reverse engineering it and figuring out how to do this. Part of it is like it teeters on an undersea shelf. Well, it has to be shallow enough that a rescue mission within a handful of hours, because the whole concept is like there's a ticking clock, right? The air pocket inside the plane is shrinking and it's running out, and you also have people breathing. You're going to have, there's just not fresh oxygen. So how do you have something that is shallow enough that a rescue mission in a handful of hours can take place, but deep enough that it's going to be a problem, but not so deep that you're at crush depth. So then I had to, that's how I wound up setting it in Hawaii, because I started researching, like, okay, where outside of an airport is there any sort of, you know, undersea topography that's going to be suitable for this? And that's how I found a shelf called Penguin Bank outside of and in Hawaii. And it was like, it was really weird as I was doing the research how much it was like, okay, this is what I need. And the more you just kept digging, it's like, oh, it actually exists. Oh, that's convenient. That's really cool. That's actually perfect. I needed that. Thank you.
Would anybody have known if you just made it up?
I don't know.
I mean, it's fiction. So
it is fiction.
If there wasn't a suitable reef, you could probably just make it up.
I suppose I could, yeah.
But still, it's more authentic if there's a real one.
But you're right. I guess I could have. Wow, that would have saved me a lot of time, energy, and research. Wait, it's fiction. I can just make this up? Huh.
Talk to me for book three. We'll work this out. Now, I have a question that just suddenly occurred to me when you were talking about the oxygen thing. And if it figures into the plot, don't answer it. But I don't remember that it does. What happens to the oxygen in the plane? Because, you know, in bad situations, the oxygen masks drop and people get to breathe the oxygen. What happens when it crashes?
What happens to the oxygen mask?
Right.
Well, the oxygen mask.
I mean the oxygen, that there must be oxygen to flow through the oxygen mask. So what's up there that makes the oxygen mask work? Are there oxygen tanks in the plane?
Oh, you mean, because it's a combustible?
No. I just mean if there is a point in a flight where oxygen masks drop down so people can breathe.
Correct.
What are they breathing? Is there oxygen stored above in the plane?
There is not. It's like an oxygen concentrator. So it's not actual bottles of oxygen up there, because that would be like massively combustible.
Right.
Yeah. Big Hindenburg again.
I never thought of it. Did any of you think of that at this very moment?
Yeah. So when you watch the safety demo and it says pull down to start the flow of oxygen, you're essentially activating the oxygen at that point. Because up until that point, it's just like a container or a canister with, Mom, I feel like we're in recurrent training. Do you know? It's just, just an oxygen generator that when you... For 12 minutes, and it's also got a time limit.
Oh, so it's a very short-term thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't really help in the situation that you're talking about the oxygen is beginning to run out.
And that's also to that point that you were just talking about the guy that opened up the door. I saw a lot of people that were like, well, why didn't the oxygen mask drop? If, like, the door's open this, and it's like they were so low. They were like, 500 feet?
He only got away with it because the plane was down almost landing.
The door shouldn't open anyway. It was just because it was literally like 400
feet. But, you know, that's actually crossed my mind a time or two when I've been on a plane. What would happen if some idiot decided... You know, that's why I don't like the exit row particularly, but then maybe I'm not an idiot, so I should always sit there and prevent anybody from doing that.
If somebody's opening that door when you're at altitude, you're fine because you got Superman on board, because nobody's opening that door unless you got, you know,
right.
Superman
strength.
Right,
have to be at that particular situation, but still, you know.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to fly in a convertible, so I would. I like door shut.
Right. So, it's all very exciting. What kind of reception has the book had so far that you can tell us about?
It's had a really good reception. You know, I'm really, quite frankly, blown away at the reception. I think I saw somewhere on Twitter today that it, on Goodreads, has like 500 five-star reviews already. I'm so proud of that. I worked so hard on this book, and to see it actually... connecting with people and actually having them really enjoy it. It's just, it really means a lot. The reception has been really, really great. I had a phenomenal review in the LA Times today, and it's exciting. It's been really, really well received.
So I'll ask you a question that I've asked Lee Child, who came to his, it's wonderful. Yay. For those of you who don't know the story behind Jack Reacher, Lee Child was fired by the BBC from his job. And that prompted him to become a writer because he had to have new employment. So we've been friends for a long time. And one day I asked him at like book 13 or something, maybe it was later than that. I said to him, so has your phenomenal success as the author of Jack Reacher and so forth made up for the fact that the BBC fired you? No, he said. So I will ask you that question. Has the phenomenal reception that you've had as a writer made up for the rejection you suffered on Broadway?
I hold, you know, I, I You know, it's interesting. I've actually been thinking about that. People have been talking to me about that whole failure time and that whole period of time. And somebody was asking me about regrets and what I do differently. And it's like, I realized, I think that part of why I was able to pursue falling with so much headwind and keep going through it was, yes, because that period of time really helped, you know, me get some thick skin. But also, I think I realized I had unfinished business. And while I have no regrets from my time in New York, and while I am so glad that I did that, I do recognize that it was unfinished business. And I think when I was facing the rejection with getting an agent, that was somewhere in the back of my mind of, I don't want to have unfinished business again. I'm going to keep going because I want to see this through. I want to see this through. And I believe in this book and I believe in this concept. And if I can just find the right person that sees what I see, I think this could really be something.
Well, maybe you were just on the wrong path, but it was the right path at the moment, but the wrong path for life, right?
Yeah.
So you got here.
Yeah. I don't think there's accidents. I'm feeling pretty serendipitously happy.
So tell us about potential movies, whatever you can talk about.
Yeah. There's not a whole ton I can say, but Drowning is being turned into a movie by Warner Brothers, which is very exciting. That followed a wild, wild week, 6 days where I just stayed in my home and did not leave and did nothing but, you know, be on Zoom calls and take phone calls and answer emails and wait by the phone and have my agent call me and say things like, you know, I've only got 30 seconds to talk, but you should know that Steven Spielberg has your book right now and he's reading it and I'm going to have a call with him tomorrow. Okay, bye.
I know her agent, and he actually does that kind of thing all the time.
All the time. All the time. And I'm like,
he really does.
I'm like, that may be a name you are familiar with. This is Mr. Spielberg to me. This is not, right. You know, this is a big deal to me. So that was insane. And then, like, another time he calls and he's like, and I'm home, right? I'm just not doing anything. I'm in the writer's uniform, sweats and no makeup and hair in a bun, you know, because that's what writers wear. And he calls and he's like, heads up, in 15 minutes, there's a really good chance we're going to be on a Zoom call with Nicole Kidman. And then he hangs up the phone. And I'm just standing there with, like, the phone to my ear. Just.
Did you rush for the bathroom in your makeup?
See, you get it. Exactly. Well,
if I were going to have a Zoom call with Nicole Kidman.
The first thought that came to my mind, I've got 15 minutes before I'm on screen with Nicole Kidman. And the first thought that comes to my mind is, I got to wash my hair.
That's right.
That's the level of, like, logic and reason that I'm working with at that point, because it's Nicole Kidman. And yes, I did. I grabbed lip gloss. I threw myself together. I figured out something.
I asked, you know, I read the wall. Every morning we get three newspapers. Our driveway looks like a flag because the New York Times comes in a blue wrapper and the Wall Street Journal comes in a red one and the Republic comes in a white one. I think the paper boy sometimes throws them in a serried way so that it really looks like one. But anyway, on Fridays, the Wall Street Journal has a whole thing, or maybe it's Saturday, about clothes and trends and all. And they were doing some interview with some influencer whose idea of putting on her makeup at a minimum is an hour. And I thought, if I spent an hour of my day just putting on makeup, I mean, I just can't even imagine that. But, you know, there are people who really devote hours.
Sure.
And with Nicole Kidman, if your face is your fortune and all the rest of it, it would make sense, right?
Sure.
But the rest of us?
I would have taken that hour, though, to get ready for
Nicole Kidman.
No, I would have taken the hour and then some. It's Nicole Kidman, yeah.
So let's have a word with your agent about more time in case we're going, like, to be talking to somebody.
If you could give me any heads up, that would be
right.
So helpful. Just, yeah.
Right. So we are going to see Drowning on screen. What about Falling?
Falling is with Universal and working title. And kind of what's really exciting about Falling is I'm actually adapting the screenplay.
Are you?
Yeah.
Oh.
Thank you. That's exciting. Thank you. And that process has been so cool, so fascinating. It has been such a learning experience to to learn how to do that and learn how to try to do it well, because it's a high wire act. I mean, it's an art of compression. You know, how do you take a book that takes 300 pages to tell and how do you bring it down to 100 pages for a script? How do you take a scene that takes, you know, 10 pages to tell and tell the exact same scene without losing any information in a single piece of paper? So it's all about compression. And also, this sounds so obvious, but I don't know, this felt like a revelation to me. It's like, it's a moving picture. So the only thing that's on the page is what you can see. You don't have the luxury in a movie and in a script of getting into the character's head, knowing what they're thinking, knowing what they're feeling. That's the luxury of a book, but you don't have that in a script. So how do you still get across the entire story when it's just what you can see on the surface?
Well, it's dialogue, and it's also, you have to rely on the actor to convey it. But then all that description that you have in a book about what the inside of the plane, you don't have to do any of that. You just say, step into the plane, because, you know, the physical set. I've had lots of conversations with people doing screenwriting, and it's harder for screenwriters to write books than it is for novelists to write scripts.
And I found
that's what we've learned.
I believe that. And I found it's also been really helpful for my novel writing, because in a script, you don't have the luxury of anything besides the story.
Right.
Right. You have to know every scene, what it's doing and what its purpose is in the story, because you just don't have the real estate that you have in a book.
Right.
And so it's really helped me as I'm writing novels to just have this relentless laser focus of, what is actually happening in this scene? And if it's not necessary, then why is it here? Get it, cut the filler, just get it out. So it's really changed how I look at story structure and just how to write a plot.
Yeah, I can see that it would be, you know, helpful for you. Speaking of books, what is your third book about? Can you give us any kind of a hint?
I can say, you know, I went bigger with this and I'm going even bigger with my next one. I'm working on something, and it's on pause right now as I'm obviously putting this out, because this is fairly all-encompassing, the act of publishing your book. But even still, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking about certain scenes, I'm thinking about certain conversations, I'm thinking about certain stuff, and I'm really excited about what I'm writing.
You know, you can't forever go up, can you?
Bigger,
right.
You know what? Okay, so when I write, also, like, conflict is the bedrock of story, right? That's that conflict. That is, every scene has to have conflict. And something that I learned with Falling and with Drowning is that, you know, in the editing process, you look and go, well, where's the escalation? And every single scene has to have an escalation. And so I don't know if there's a limit, but of how high you can go up, how much bigger you can make it, but I'm on the hunt. I'm searching for it. Because it's gotta escalate.
Patrick, you're over there. Do we have any questions from the audience before he's going to check? Right. But meantime, how about questions from any of you? Kurt, Tori, why don't you take over? And
yeah.
So, Tori, the first novel came out and it was put out again. So now you've got the second novel. We're not the same as bigger and better. What? How was it different since this time around? You had clout.
That's a good question. Also, the idea that I had clout is like, what? Me? Like,
what she has is an agent who has clout.
There you go. Yeah, I have a very good agent. But you know, when I wasn't super involved in every aspect of the bidding process for Falling, my first book. Because the way that it happened was I announced Falling, and within days, the manuscript had leaked in Hollywood, and there was interest, and then there was a lot of interest, and then people started bidding against, and it was like this whole overwhelming thing. Within a 1 week period from the moment that I announced, like, publicly that I'd even written a book. So my entire life was flipped on its head literally over the course of like a week. And it was so overwhelming, and I knew absolutely nothing, that my agent was kind of like, you know, he had the reins fully. It was like, I would have only been in the way. So I was involved in that process, but not like in a very like in-depth way on a day-to-day basis. With drowning, I was actively involved in the whole time. So it was my first time actually seeing that, actually being in the room, even though it was on Zooms, with studio executives and Oscar-winning directors and Nicole Kidman. So it was my first time being in that situation. And it was so humbling. I just felt like it was such a privilege to be with such creative powerhouses, right? Like I know this story backwards. I have figured out the best way to tell this story. So I thought, and then I got into a room with various executives who were all pitching to me their idea of what they thought the best way to tell this story was. And it was so inspiring and so humbling, because it was just like idea after idea was just like, oh, that's good. You know what I mean? It's like, but that's how, you know, that's why they're studio executives. That's why they're Oscar winning directors. And to be around that kind of creative, just energy, you know, at that tier, at that level, was really just a privilege. And it was an incredible, incredible experience.
I see Patrick does have a comment or two to read.
Yes, there's a question from Christina Estes, our friend. She says, I don't really expect an answer to this, but will the third book title end in ing?
And the question is, will the third book title also end in ing?
If nothing else, for the great suggestions, because now that it's like one and two, like people keep coming up with like the best ones, and I'm like, oh, that's good. I didn't know.
What was that, Dead Stick, or what was the
Dead Stick? That's what we were talking about before. Yeah. It's a good title.
I'm going to paraphrase this because it's on YouTube, but there was a fellow flight attendant, and he wanted to know, how do flight attendants deal with being shuffled around from different airplanes on a duty day?
How do we deal with being shuffled around? I guess just be ready for anything. I mean, that's sort of like, you know, the theme of aviation is like, you never know when you're going to get a tail swap. You're supposed to be on one plane. All of a sudden you're on something else. You're supposed to be flying with this crew. Suddenly you're flying with that crew. I mean, that's kind of the excitement of, and also the torture of being a flight attendant, is you never know what cards you're going to be dealt that day. So you just kind of adapt and go with it.
Right. And a huge problem is getting crews to planes on time anymore. We had an author here, well, Jack, a couple of weeks ago, who was hours late arriving because when he got from his first flight to his second flight, there wasn't any pilot. And so they had to wait. They had to hold the plane and they had to wait until they were able to get an actual pilot, you know, to that place. So just relocating crews is extremely difficult these days.
Repositioning and mechanicals and weather.
And weather.
Yeah.
Right. Now, extra turbulence in the air for flying, that, you know, that's a new thing where you're going to have to wear your seatbelt all the time because you never know.
What? You should have been doing that the whole time. Come on.
True.
I will never not be a flight attendant. I had someone actually, this was funny. I had someone write a comment. There's a scene early on where they talk about, this isn't like a spoiler or anything, but there's a person who has their laptop out basically during the crash, and you see what happens when an electronic device is not properly stowed for takeoff and landing. Right. You see what the result can be. And I had someone write who was like, I was just on a flight and the guy sitting next to me did not stow his computer for landing. And I was so nervous the whole time because I know what could happen if you don't stow your electronic devices. And I was like, still got it. Still keeping him safe.
That's right. Absolutely. Any more?
Let me take the mic around too.
Oh, okay. That'd be great.
I do know that the wife, Chris, she is active in commercial diving operations. Mm-hmm. What kind of research did you do for that? Because that's a little bit different, rescuing people from a plane.
Absolutely. I had to research everything because once, you know, and I sort of made this connection to, it's like, I'm good on a plane. And when the plane's in the air, you know, that's a plane. When the plane's on the surface of the water, it's a boat, actually. And then when the plane sinks, well, that's a submarine. And I had to basically reframe my mind, because once the plane was down there, I kept trying to like apply, you know, aviation stuff. And I was like, this isn't applicable. Like, it doesn't matter anymore. It could be anything. You could be in a car at this point, because it's no longer a plane. So I had to research everything. There's a huge rescue component. God, it's so hard to not be able to talk about the book. Yeah, I know. I don't want to spoil, but I had to deal with the military, and I got in touch with some Navy personnel who were willing to talk to me and give me as much information as a curious civilian is allowed to have. I got scuba certified, which was really cool. Really cool, because I knew that there was no way that I was going to be able to write about breathing underwater, which, you know, shouldn't happen and is a completely foreign thing to do. I knew I wouldn't be able to write that unless I knew what that felt like. And there's a scene in the book where one of the divers, he describes his memory of, you know, when he was a teen, when he went on his first dive, and what that felt like and what that was. And it was like, that was just my experience. That's exactly how I felt when I went down the first time. So I did a ton of research, and Chris, she's a industrial diver and does marine construction. She's so great. I love that character. I haven't thought about her in a long time. It's funny when you put out the book, all of a sudden it goes from being inside the book to being outside the book. And it's actually weird. I've never made that connection, that it's like, I haven't thought about the characters in that sort of like way and how I researched them and how I came up with them. But for Chris, for that industrial diving component, YouTube is your friend. Honestly, there are so many videos and so much. That was like the place that I started. And then I just kept diving from there. Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
I think YouTube is remarkable for the things you can find out how to do.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. As a new, rather new novelist, I guess we'll say.
Congratulations.
I'm referring to more.
Yeah, I thought you were a new novelist. I was like, yay.
Can you tell us if there are any writers that influenced you or that you think you learned something from in order to prep yourself to do this?
I feel like this is going to feel like a cop-out answer, but like, I read a lot of thrillers, but I read across all genres, and I read a ton of nonfiction, and I feel like I learned something from all of them. When I was writing this book, one of the most important pieces of research that I did was I read The Perfect Storm, the book of The Perfect Storm, which is a nonfiction book, but it reads like fiction. And I used that because I wanted... When you're writing something this big and this sensational, it's very easy to lean into melodrama. And I knew that would just hurt the story. So for me, the only way to avoid that melodrama and that sensationalism was to err on the side of simple and more like nonfiction that reads like fiction, especially in the beginning several chapters where the plane is crashing and we're basically getting to the setup of what the rest of the story happens. So for this book, that was one of the biggest pieces of inspiration that I had was The Perfect Storm. Yeah.
That was a phenomenal book in which everything that could go wrong did go wrong. Yeah. Exactly the scenario that you are working out for drowning.
Exactly.
Any of you familiar with The Perfect Storm? It's the sea thing. I mean, it's a boat disaster.
And there's a great movie, but the book is so good. Highly recommend it.
Okay, I have a pre-question that will define if my question's actually asked. So in Drowning, the father and the daughter, they're just civilian writers?
Yeah, everyone's just a regular passenger, just like you and me. And that's something that I really liked with both my books is just, which I'm thinking I'm discovering as a theme, is just ordinary people in extraordinary situations.
So I guess my question is, so the first book is really from the perspective of the crew, mm-hmm. and this book, it sounds like, will be the perspective from someone who's a passenger. Was that hard for you to write? Also having such a background and knowledge in the industry where you're like, what do people think when they don't have all this background knowledge and context?
There's definitely still some crew involved. It's not a spoiler. You find out pretty early. Not everybody walks away from this, crew or passengers. You know, it's an intense beginning, but it was actually really fun to look a little bit more at the passenger angle. There was a lot of feedback that I got when Falling came out that a lot of people were like, I was curious about the passengers. Like, I knew you need a little bit more of the passengers. And Falling, like, you're almost not with the passengers at all. They're almost very peripheral characters. There's a couple standouts, but we don't really go into the characters' worlds. It's just about the crew and the family on the ground. And there was so much feedback that was like, oh, I kind of wanted to know more about the passengers. And I realized it's like, well, duh, because most of the people reading this book are passengers. They're not pilots and flight attendants. They're passengers. That's what they identify with. That's what shortens, you know, the distance between fiction and reality to them, is that they're not a flight attendant, so they can't identify with that, but they have sat in that window seat before and they know what that feels like. So I made a active decision to include more passengers and look more into that. And it was also, you know, it's interesting. I also just recently made this connection too, is that as a flight attendant, you get 100 some new passengers every single flight, 100 new some strangers that you're studying basically. It's a character study every time, because we are trained to be constantly situationally aware and looking and going like, she looks a little sick. Is this going to evolve into a medical emergency at altitude? Does this man appear to be intoxicated? You know, is this person, you know, showing a proclivity for noncompliance already? You know, we're constantly looking and reading the room and reading people to figure out where they're at. And that's just character study. That's just character study. So I think, you know, being surrounded by 100 new characters every single flight for 10 years, it wasn't that hard to kind of just extend the movie in my mind for this person that I don't know anything about, who's just stepped on the plane and I'm trying to read. I just took that a little bit further.
Whose idea was it to use almost the exact same cover?
You know, we talked about that. I love that first cover was so good. And because we went with another ING title and because it was another aviation incident, you know, aviation epic, we thought that it just made sense to make them like a companion piece. I'm very happy with the.
Those decisions now. Those decisions are made by the sales and marketing departments of publishers, not by others. If you're fortunate, they will ask you if you like it, but that's about as far as it goes. Yeah. No, really. The publisher owns everything but the story. The publisher has a copyright in the art, in the typography, and all of the production. The author has a copyright in the words. So, you know.
It was really cool. I mean, that first cover for Falling, you know, the cover designer and my agent worked together, and my agent Shane Salerno basically pitched an idea of a plane inverted, you know, with the colors. Like, he basically pitched the idea for what he saw, and then the designer, Allison Forner, she took it and ran with it and came back with a cover, and they sent it to me, you know, they sent me the PDFs and said, hey, this is what we're thinking. What do you think? And I clicked on it and opened up, and it was like, I mean, it was just one of those moments where you're just like, oh my God. And that was it. That was the one we went with. The very first draft was the one we went with. I mean, there was like probably 40 more drafts after that of different tweaks and variations, but we went back to the first one.
Tori, I'd like to have you speak a little bit about when you were getting the rejections for Falling and what kept you going. And is there a number where you would have finally said, okay, it's been 99 rejections, I'm going to stop, or anything like that? And what was it that kept you going?
Every time that I would get close to pulling the plug, and it happened often, I can tell you every single one of those 42 rejections hurt. I felt every single one of them, and it was very tempting to believe the message that they were telling me, which was, I mean, these are the experts, right? These are the people who know. They're the agents. They know what sells, what works, what's good. And it is a consensus. They are all telling me that this isn't it. No, this isn't good enough. It was very tempting to give in to that and just stop. But every time that I would get close to that point, I would remind myself that I didn't come this far just to come this far. And I would keep going. And I want to credit also my family for supporting me during that too. Because a lot of those times that I also wanted to give up and quit, they were the people who were also there saying, no, keep going. You've got this. And I wouldn't be here without their support.
Let me speak up and say, as I frequently do speak up, voice is really, in the end, what makes most people bond to a book. I mean, the idea can be great or the characters could be interesting, but if you're bored by the author's voice, you're not going to read the book, right? You must have all had that experience. And you often wonder, probably, some point you've picked up a book that other people like and it doesn't do a thing for you. I hope you're smart enough at that point to put it down. You don't have to clean your plate for the starving children in China. You don't have to finish a book that doesn't work for you. So how is it that a book that is so successful had 42 rejections? And the answer is it had to find that person with power who liked the voice. And sometimes it takes a long time for that to happen. So it isn't that the people who rejected it were crazy. You know, it just, sometimes it's a long process to find a person. It has to be a person with power. It has to be a person who can actually buy the book and shepherd it through the incredible publication process. And sometimes, as I said, you know, it's along there people who've had many more rejections than Tori who finally got published. And now you look back and you think, how is that possible? You know, that everybody didn't leap on it and, you know, buy it at day one, but it doesn't work that way.
And some of the best rejection, which feels counterintuitive, the best rejection, but the, you know, some of the, yeah, it was helpful, but it was also, and I thought, you know, that's the point too, is that someone would say, I like this. I think this is great, but I don't connect with it in a way that I need to in order to do what needs to be done to make it a success. And I do think that part of that is, you know, it's just the fit. It's the right fit. And I think that helps you keep going too, just knowing that, you know, there is somewhere out there that fit. And I knew once I found someone who got it, who saw what I saw and what it could be and was willing to help me try to make it happen. I knew it was out there.
Sometimes publishers have already got one or two books that are too similar already on their list, and they feel like they can't devote their resources to yet another book. So sometimes it's just timing, sure. You know, that your book may come out. For example, I find this just amazing looking at the news. We've all heard about the Supreme Court and questions about ethics and all. Three books published in May, three books, all of which were written more than a year ago, in which the Supreme Court justice is either the bad actor or whatever. And you think, how is that possible? Because up until then, I can't remember a single book where a Supreme Court justice was a player. I mean, none. So how does that happen? And I think there's some weird thing in the zeitgeist that authors who are particularly tuned, you know, to what's going on in the world kind of pick up on things. There are military thriller writers who are actually asked to do gaming at the Pentagon to help figure out, you know, how the wars and so forth should go. So I think writers have an unusual sensitivity, but the problem is that too many of them may have the same idea at the same time. And, you know, so, I mean, timing has a lot to do with, nobody was writing an airplane thriller at the moment that your book went out.
And that's actually a really good point. And that was something also when I was writing the book, because it was also like, if anybody's tried to write a book, it's a long, hard process and you're all alone and the pages aren't good. And there's a lot of reasons to just not finish. And when I was writing that book, Falling, and when I was convincing myself to keep going with that, and I was also trying to convince myself, like, should I keep going with this? One of the reasons that I knew I had to keep going was I asked myself, like, who else is going to write this? During that period of time when I was, like, in my 20s and I didn't know what I was going to do, I took a class in entrepreneurship at the Phoenix Public Library. And I was like, well, maybe I'll start a business. Maybe I'll be an entrepreneur. So I took this entrepreneur class. And I remember one of the classes, they were talking about why you should start a business. And they used an example of a pizzeria. And they said, anybody can open a pizzeria. And you see pizzerias on every single corner. And if you open a pizzeria, it's going to be a lot of work and it's going to be really hard. And there's a good chance a good chance it won't succeed. So if you're going to go all through that, you need to answer the question, what is my pizzeria going to do that no other pizzeria is going to do? And if you can answer that question and have a good answer for that, then you probably have a good idea that you should work that hard and pursue. And when I was writing Falling, that was one of the things in my mind was like, I don't know who's going to write this book. This story, this concept is so good. And I don't know who else would write it. Who else is, you know, has this kind of access, who is asking these questions and is doing this and is here doing that. Like, I felt like, you know, it was the right opportunity and the right situational placement that it felt like something I had to do.
I've got the mic. I guess, is it on? So I guess I have the power. I'm really interested. I'm just curious about the physical writing of the book. Are you plucking on computer keys? Are you speaking to someone? Do you have people doing, getting your ideas out? How does it work?
It's definitely just me plunking away on a keyboard. Yeah, it's I wrote my first book. A lot of it I wrote by hand in the galley at work. But this book was almost entirely on the computer. And the biggest difference in my process from the first book to the second book was with my first book, I was a pantser, right? In the writing community, you can either be a plotter or a pantser. And a pantser is somebody who writes by the seat of their pants. They don't know the story. They just sit down, start writing, and the story, you know, comes to them as they write. Falling took me, you know, 30-some drafts to get right and several years to come to fruition. I knew I did not have that kind of luxury with the second book, so I became a plotter, which is somebody who plots everything out ahead of time. So I outlined extensively for this book, and I knew exactly what was going to happen and what needed to happen before I ever put pen to paper or keyboard to finger. Finger to keyboard,
right?
Yeah.
Tori, two things. One, I'm really glad you didn't give up. And from the time that you got that yes, so it was, what, 40-some before that, what clicked and how much time elapsed from the time you got that yes to when it was actually published on Falling? What's that process when you get that yes? Take it from there.
Yeah, so I got that one yes in November of 2019. And we started working together and started, you know, getting the manuscript where it needed to be before we could start taking it to publishers. And then the pandemic hit, which kind of threw a problem to everything. And so I spent the pandemic, you know, in my house by myself, you know, isolating and writing. And I worked on Falling the entire pandemic long. And then it came out in July of 2021. So that was sort of the period of time with that. Did that answer the question? Absolutely. So my agent's also a writer himself. So there were many drafts that came after that because he knew the writing was good. He knew the story was good, but I wasn't telling it just right. And I knew that too. When I was sending out my manuscript to those agents, it was one of those things where it's like, I've taken this as far as I can take it. I believe it's as good of a story as I can tell. Who can come in now and like help me take it over the finish line? And my agent helped me see all the places where things needed to change, things needed to get better, because he's a writer and a screenwriter himself. So he knew what it needed. And I remember during that process when there were major changes happening and big stuff going on. I mean, major stuff happening. I remember my mom who's been, she was the first person to read the first draft, and she'd read pretty much every draft, you know, since all 30 some of them. And I remember her saying to me, this is still your book, right? like there's a lot of changes going on, like, and we didn't know him really, you know. I just started working together. It was just like, you know, this agent that came in, and it was like, her point was like, you know, are you sure this is still your book? I want to make sure that you're okay with the changes. And I told my mom, I said, what's weird is all of these changes are just making it the book that I was originally trying to write, but didn't know how. And it was like he could see the story that I wanted to tell but didn't know how, and then helped guide me and teach me how to get there. Like my coach, yeah, yeah. And it was crazy because I pulled out that first draft, the final draft of Falling that I wrote, I referenced the very first draft that I wrote. I pulled out the very first draft and put stuff from the first draft of that book into the final draft that had been cut along the way. And I realized that it was actually there, and he helped me find it again.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, okay. Hi, Tori. Okay, so you dedicated this book to Grant and Davis, the Weasels. Who are the Weasels?
The Weasels are my nephews. They are my nephews. And I have to give my nephews, actually, I have to give the Weasels actually a lot of credit on this, too. When Falling was coming out, my sister sent me a video one day, and it was them reading their book, which was titled Plain. And it was incredible. And it was, you know, on the first page, I think we had, what, 3 tornadoes, 2 hurricanes? I mean, that was by the end of the first page. We'd gone through 3 hurricanes and 2 tornadoes, and we're still going. And I remember seeing this video of them, and they were so excited, and they were telling me this story, which was awesome. And I just thought, I want that feeling, that sort of like, forget logic, forget reason. How big can I make this? How cool can this be? Just go there and start there. And that helped me get to the point with this book that I could really, you know, think like that, think with that kind of creative possibility that a child has. So I dedicated the book to them because the Weasels really helped me get back to that creative state where I can really go, what if, without an asterisk attached.
Tori. Hello. It was so cool when I saw you in our at church and realized you were the person I had heard interviewed years earlier about this book. I thought, afterward, I told you the book creeped me out and I wasn't going to buy it when you described it, but then I bought 4 copies, so I have those. and I tore right through it. But my question is, did you fight with your editor and agent ever? I mean, disagreements? You stood your ground or
I think
locked horns at all?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I'm not very precious like that. Like, I really like criticism. I really like notes. I really like hearing how to make a story better. I don't feel very much like it's my baby, you shouldn't touch it. You know, this is, no, I don't feel that way at all. I want that criticism. I want that feedback because I just want to tell the best story I can. And the more eyes that I can get on a story that know what they're doing and can help me get it to the best story, because it's about the story. It's not about me. It's not about my ego. It's just about how do I tell this story the best way possible.
In theory, it's a collaborative process where everybody's trying to make it better. Yeah. And I think it's a foolish author that rejects
absolutely
at least considering. Yeah. What's going on?
I'd be very curious to ask that question, though, to my agent and to the people who read these.
That's very true.
They may have a different answer,
and
but I don't think.
It might be a different answer from Tori 4 or 5 books from now, too. So, never, you know, say never. I think we've come to the point where we want to thank Tori very much for sharing her time with us this evening on her publication day. Yay. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.